It's the middle of the month, and you know what that means.
That if I don't raise $10,000 by next Tuesday, my husband will be sold into white slavery?
No, it's time for another episode of Allopod. This month, we're interviewing historian Dr. Bill Youngs and dispelling myths about influenza, including the much-talked-about avian flu. But first, here's Eric Ostrom with Everything You Read.
And you said, trouble's my profession. If you're looking for confessions, settle in for a long, long stay. And you said, time is of the essence. It'll grace you with its presence till the end of a long, long day. And you said, and you said, and you said goodbye. Are flying through the air like Jesus dying and coming back 3 days on. And you said love is all you need, but now you're on the sidewalk bleeding from the wounds of a love gone wrong. And you said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you said, baby. And you said goodbye. And I believed everything you said, and you probably did too. But you can't believe everything you read, and I can no longer believe in you. And you said, it's time to go, but you were already gone.
Oh, that was Everything You Read by Eric Ostrom.
Good song.
Yeah, it was a good song.
I like his sound.
He's got it's interesting because his music, like other bands we've had on here, mm-hmm. like Vote for Pedro as well, our first band, there's sort of an eclectic sound. There are a bunch of different sort of styles and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm getting into that sound that mixes a lot of genres.
Yeah, and so he has a pretty good representation of different types of sound. So we'll definitely have a link to his music in the show notes. So if you read the little blurb about what the description of this month's show, I posited, you know, what's the difference between a historian and this month's superior person's word, histrion or histrion or
histrion,
something like that. And so I'm going to say historian because it
sounds
more like historian, and I like the confusion.
Yeah, works.
Anyway, a historian is simply an actor, and in the superior person's book it says, the adjective histrionic today carries implications of exaggeration in acting style, and in the 18th century a histrion was someone who played the buffoon. Perhaps well illustrated in the person of Robert Coates, universally known in his time as Romeo Coates, because he specialized in the role of Romeo, which he played in a blue silk coat covered with spangles, a Charles II wig, and a top hat. In playing the death scene, he would first carefully sweep with his silk handkerchief the spot on stage where he intended to fall, then remove his hat and set it neatly beside him on the floor. Then take several minutes in laying down, turning around and about, until he found the most comfortable position. Audiences hysterical with laughter would demand and receive numerous encores of this scene. According to Caulfield, contemporary reports of his acting style describe him as having, quote, an inflexibility of limb, an awkwardness of gait, and an idiotic manner of standing still, which evoked hysteria, even before he opened his mouth to speak. There's a good history lesson.
Yeah,
there,
it is.
See, look at that. It all comes together, as things often do on Allopod.
Yes.
Today we're talking about not just history, but, you know, contemporary events, as we want to do. And
yeah.
The main contemporary event we're focusing on today is avian flu, and just sort of influenza in general. For the first time, my fiancée will be joining us on the show. So hello to her. Hello, Maura.
Hello.
How are you?
Pretty good.
You'll probably just want to stay leaning forward there and be easier than undulating back and forth from the microphone.
Although that would give you a great ab workout.
I probably would, actually.
There,
okay, good tip. Do a podcast, get great abs.
There you go.
So, So we have some questions here. We came up with the influenza, the avian flu and whatnot. Now, the avian flu is called H5N1, and so we're kind of wondering, why is it called that?
The H stands for hemagglutinin, and the N stands for neuraminidase, and those are two proteins on the surface of the virus, and the numbers are just basically which hemagglutinin and which neuraminidase are on the surface, like which ones that the virus actually is presenting.
So could there be like an H5N2 or an H6N3 or something like that?
Yes, actually there are very many different types of H's and N's. There can be all sorts of combinations of them too. The most common types of influenza A that infect people are H1N1, H1N2, and H3N2.
And so why is this H5N1 the one that everyone's concerned about? Isn't it some other one that's the big deadly one?
Well, this one originates in birds, and wild birds are the natural host for this virus. And typically, they don't get sick when they're infected with this virus, but domestic poultry can be infected with it and then end up becoming ill and die. Birds aren't very similar to people as far as what receptor sites the virus looks for. And so people are kind of concerned because the recent infections that have happened in humans have been pretty severe and pretty deadly.
And now that stems as a result of it being a virus that's supposed to be for birds, so our bodies don't know what the hell's going on when we
right,
get it.
Right.
Okay. Mm. So would there be any locations or countries or something, anything like that on the planet that would be immune or safe from this virus?
Not really. Right now, the United States has not seen a case. That's basically because of our cultural practices. I mean, you don't go down into the streets of like Spokane and see live poultry being slaughtered or kept, you know, on the streets. Poultry farms are pretty well regulated and things like that. Places in Asia, more rural countries, you see a lot of that. There are a lot of live birds. There are a lot of people packed in really tightly along with these birds. Yeah.
So we have some, you know, West Nile virus has spread from birds to birds and things like that via mosquitoes. Is that the kind of thing that we should be worried about here as well?
Avian influenza does not have a mosquito vector. It is mostly transmitted through nasal secretions and feces in birds. The feces being the most contaminated part. So anything like humans have gotten the virus from the birds by being in close contact with infected birds or by handling things that have been infected with bird feces.
You know, when I think of birds, I don't exactly think nasal secretions are a possibility. But now that you point that out, I suppose they do have little noses.
Yeah,
they
do. They do.
Never thought of that, though.
I'm sure they might get runny noses, too, when they get, you know, flu.
Interesting.
Little bird Kleenex. Somebody patent that idea. It's going to be big, especially with the whole bird flu, you know. So as the time of this recording, there's currently not a vaccine, correct?
Well, actually, I found this lovely news release on the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. It's part of the National Institutes of Health.
Is there a date on that?
I'm pretty sure there probably is.
Okay, well, recent
we'll,
though, very
we'll
recent.
We'll find that link for you.
Okay, we'll put the link to this article in the show notes.
Yes, anyway, it says that Sanofi Pasteur in Swiftwater, Pennsylvania, manufactured a trial vaccine, and it is made from the inactivated vaccine of H5N1, and this is very common. All flu vaccines are inactivated vaccines. They used the H5N1 virus isolated in Southeast Asia in 2004, and they were awarded a contract to manufacture this vaccine in May of 2004. And the phase one trial of the test will see how safe the vaccine is and how good it is at generating an immune response. And they're going to test 450 healthy adults age 18 to 64. And if the vaccine is shown to be safe in adults, there are plans to test it in other populations such as elderly and children.
Okay, you say safe in adults. Now, could somebody catch the flu from this vaccine?
No, they can't. The way an inactivated vaccine works is that the live virus is cultured, and the main way of culturing these vaccines is using chicken eggs. So they culture the live virus in the chicken eggs, and then the virus is chemically inactivated after it's grown and reproduced and they have enough of it, and then stored in this vaccine. So basically they're just sending dead virus particles into your body. And the reason why this works is because mainly when you make an immune response to a virus, what you're looking at and making the response to are certain specific things on the virus's outer envelope or capsid. And so therefore, if you're just sending the dead virus in, you have the structure there for your body to go, oh, what's this? And make its antibodies against those different structural parts.
So it's like sending in a photograph, but not the actual person in that respect.
Right, because
look for this. Be on the lookout.
When the when you actually get sick with a live virus, you're not actually making any antibodies toward the things that cause it to be virulent and cause the pathogenicity in your body. You're just making the antibodies against the things on its structural self.
So why don't you explain real quick, and as simply as you can, how it is that I think a good lead into this is that you can never have the same flu twice.
Yeah.
Because your body recognizes the ones you've already had. And so the way you get flus every year is because they mutate, the virus mutates. And so, you know, that's the fear that we have here, is that it's going to be a mutation that's going to allow it to go human to human, right?
Yeah, that's what they're fearing, is that it will have a mutation that allows it to be more readily accepted by human hosts, and then much more transmittable between human hosts and more contagious. Right now, our bodies aren't used to it. It's like something completely different. When we get new viruses from animals, one of two things can happen. Either you don't even know you have it. You don't even know you're infected with it, because it just doesn't do anything. It can't find a good receptor that it recognizes within your body, so therefore it has no effect. Or it finds a receptor that it likes, and your body is so it's so new to it that it's actually really deadly. And that's what they're afraid of with this flu. And with viruses, they go through antigenic drift, and this occurs through small changes in the virus that happen continually over time. And antigenic drift, it produces new virus strains that may not be recognized by antibodies to earlier influenza strains. And so if a person, you know, when they're infected with a flu virus, develops an antibody against that virus, but as newer virus strains appear, the antibodies to the older strains no longer recognize the newer viruses, and the infection with the new strain can occur. And that's why one of the main reasons why people get flu, more than once in their lifetime. You can get flu every single year. In most years, there are two or three viruses in the influenza vaccine that are updated regularly as they decide which flu viruses are going to be the most common ones. And they have to predict this a year in advance, because it takes a whole year to produce influenza vaccines. So sometimes they're right on, and sometimes they're not so right on. So a lot of people end up getting sick.
That's one of the things that actually really surprised me when you told me, is that the flu vaccine isn't just for like, oh, this is the flu that might be there. There are like a whole bunch of different inactive viruses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually three viruses in every flu vaccine. And another thing that I was thinking of is that because the flu vaccine is made from inactivated virus, it doesn't produce a super strong immune response. And I mean, the flu vaccine won't guarantee that you won't get the flu. It'll just help your body react sooner, so that hopefully...
Mm-hmm. So it's not as bad.
Right. So hopefully it'll be a lot better. And because it's not as strong of a response, it doesn't last as long, which is also why you need to get regular flu vaccines, because not only do they change what's in it, but it's not going to, it might only last a couple years, your immunity, and then it's just going to fade away, because your body doesn't keep what it's not, you know, what hasn't responded really strongly to and what it's not using. It starts getting rid of some of that stuff.
So then could you get the same flu twice?
You could. Most likely you wouldn't. You'd probably be getting another variation because it changes so often. But yeah, you definitely could. It could be possible.
Do the strains just like die out because everybody's already had the flu and so it doesn't really have, it's unable to find a host?
I'm not sure. I think that mostly they change and mutate so much that you just never really see a lot of the same ones. The other type of change, and this is what they're fearing with the avian influenza, is influenza viruses can go through antigenic shift. And this is an abrupt major change in the influenza A virus, and it results in a new influenza virus that can infect humans. And it usually contains an H and N protein that haven't been seen in humans for many years. And antigenic shift results in new influenza A subtypes. And when these are introduced in the human population, people have little or no protection against the new virus, and it can spread easily from person to person, and therefore a pandemic can occur.
Yeah, that's scary stuff.
Yeah, it is.
Sure.
You're not afraid, Emily?
I'm not, actually. I'm really not afraid of pandemics. My theory is that we doubt people. I know that's cold and hard, you know, evil, but it will kill people, and therefore the planet will be less populated, and all those people complaining about other people having children can shut the hell up, because everyone died. I know that's mean, but...
Well, what people don't realize is that every year, many, many people die from influenza. Yeah. Most people think it's not really all that, you know, big of a deal. But most of the time, the people who die from it are young children and elderly or immunocompromised people. And so what people are afraid of with this avian flu and things like that is in the past there have been flus that target young, healthy people and kill them. And so people are like, anybody could get this, get really sick and die. And therefore it's like a bigger scare.
Yeah, like the Spanish pandemic killed mainly people in the age group that doesn't get the flu.
Right.
The younger and the elderly actually rarely got it.
Right.
And if they did, they didn't even die from it. They actually got through it easier than someone our age would in their 20s.
So what's the purpose of a flu, really? Like, is it just kind of like anything else? Its purpose is just to hang out and be groovy?
Well, there's a lot of debate to the origin of viruses and everything, but basically viruses...
Well, hon, there's a lot of debate to the origin of life.
That's true. That's true. I mean, if people can't figure out where life comes from, why viruses, you know? And viruses aren't really alive, so you'd think, but...
Wait, they aren't really alive?
No, they're not considered a living thing. They're very... in a very weird category. And the best way to describe a virus is an obligate intracellular parasite, which just basically means that they have to have a host to live, or not live, but survive, basically, and replicate and make more of themselves. They can't just, you know, be free living in the environment. They can last for a little while in an environment, but they actually need a host cell to replicate and make more of themselves.
See, Chris, that's why the AIDS juice didn't bother me at all. I'm not going to explain that. He'll understand. Too bad for the rest of you. Let's see. I think I have some. Oh, a good question I had was, how is H5N1 different from SARS?
H5N1 is a flu virus, and SARS is a really virulent cold virus, and so those are two completely different types of viruses.
And so they spread similarly, though, don't they? I mean, they're both airborne.
Yeah, airborne respiratory viruses. Usually cold viruses are really, really tissue specific. They really like the nasopharynx region of humans and kind of like to stay in that area. They're usually less severe than flu viruses, although SARS has proved to be kind of a counter to that, but...
So we've been talking about avian to human and human to human. How about human to animal? Does that happen?
Do we know about that? Can cats get the flu? Because I've heard that your cat can get your flu.
I don't know.
I think that's kind of like the cat eat your face myth.
Yeah, might be.
Yeah, I don't usually. The problem with that question is that
how do you know
nobody
when a cat has a flu?
Cares?
Yeah.
Only thing we care about is ourselves. So we care what are we getting from other animals, not what are we giving to other animals. We don't care what we give them.
Come on, there are research grants to find out the weirdest things you'd never, ever, ever want to know.
Why I'm sure some people care.
Yeah, I want to know if my cat can get my flu and if I have to make sure he's not eating my tissues.
I would be more careful about it.
Right, yeah. I know that some people care.
Emily,
but
your cat shouldn't be eating your tissues anyway.
Well, yeah, I do. I know, but I mean, if I had a cold, maybe I would be a little more responsible
about
cleaning them up.
Maybe you have viruses in your sputum that you're not aware of, and in your mucosal stuff. See, you don't know.
That's true.
I
don't let him eat the tissues anyway. He just gets them, and then if I catch him with them, I throw them away.
Okay, so I mean, what can we do to protect ourselves against this? This is obviously something that people are going to be very and are very concerned about. I know every year a lot of people get the flu vaccine, and there are some people who don't. For both of those groups, what are we going to do?
Basically, the only thing I can say is just do what you're supposed to do with any flu virus. I mean, basically, you need to keep your hands clean and don't be touching, or try not to. It's so hard not to touch your eyes and your nose and your mouth, because, I mean, those are the places that they like to infect. That's the tissue that those viruses like. And if your hands are contaminated, it's just going straight to the source. And basically, if you're sick, stay home. Like, don't spread it around to other people. Just take care of yourself.
Now, the entire time that you're sick with the flu, are you able to give it to other people, or is there a time period where you're shedding more of the virus that other people could catch?
There are times during the flu cycle that you are more contagious. Usually, though, it kind of, unfortunately, happens right before you really get sick. I mean, you are very, very contagious while you are sick. I mean, one of the things that makes flu so contagious is the fact that it makes you cough and sneeze. Oh, and what are you doing? You're spreading the respiratory droplets with the flu virus in them to other people who have to breathe. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why it's such a good virus. And but a lot of times you're very contagious right before you really, really get sick. With a lot of viruses are like that.
So what about things like face masks and hand sanitizer?
Hand sanitizer does a good job of killing viruses. Soap does a good job of killing viruses. So just wash your hands with good old soap.
Regular soap, too, not antibacterial
soap. Yeah, just regular soap, because virus envelopes and, like, their protein capsules break down in the presence of soap. They don't like soap. Destroys them.
Okay, one more question for you, Maura, before we release you into the wild. If someone does catch H5N1, what can they do to mitigate the effects?
I don't know. Basically, I think they've tried to test some of the current antivirals on people, and a few of them aren't very effective against avian flu, but a few of them, it hasn't been proven whether they are or not. They should be, but the thing with antivirals is that you have to go in pretty much within 48 hours of getting the virus to have it be effective. You have to stop it, like, right away. And a lot of people, you know, wait until they really feel bad to go in, and so it's too late to get an antiviral by then.
So at that point, would it become more damage control? Try not to get other people infected.
Right, yeah. And just try to take care of yourself and, you know, get sleep and do what you usually do when you have a flu virus. Stay, you know, well hydrated and everything, and just get a lot of sleep. Because, I mean, you can't really take anything to get rid of a virus once it's really taken hold in your body. And hopefully you just have a strong enough immune system to fight it off.
All right, well, I would like to thank you for joining us on the show. Perhaps we'll have you on in the future.
Yes, you're very cute.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, my fiance, Maura, she's the or the Allopod, official Allopod science nerd.
Yay, science.
Also in the, joining us in the room, although sans microphone, is Emily's husband, Mike, who is the official Allopod historian.
Yay, historians.
And speaking of historians, one of Mike's teachers, Professor Dr. Bill Youngs, is joining us. Well, did join us previously. We have a recording of the interview we did with him out at the KEWU, the radio station at Eastern, where I was previously a DJ. Wow, we know a lot of people out there, too. The program director out there, Elizabeth, she actually graduated with her from the film program.
Yeah.
So very cool that she was able to
stay. She recently won an award, too.
Did she really?
Yeah, for best jazz programmer in small market.
Wow. Yeah. You know, KEWU is the only full-time jazz station in the Inland Northwest. You can listen to the broadcast over the internet, something that Elizabeth has helped to pioneer. We're going to have links to all of that in the show notes. Here's our interview with Dr. Bill Youngs and his explanation of what other jobs you can have besides historian if you get a history degree. So here's that interview. Well, we have been teasing our listeners with it for 2 months now, so tell us, what kind of job can you get with a history degree besides a history teacher?
Well, you can be a history teacher, there's one, but you've mentioned that. Basically, it's a lead-in to lots of other kinds of jobs in professional school. For example, lawyers would be an obvious one. Another would be simply in business, that there are a lot of business executives now that want somebody with a liberal arts background, and history is a good one. Researcher, archivist, librarian, those are some of them, but there's nothing wrong with being a historian, teaching it, writing it.
So why is history important?
Well, I guess you could say, why is life is important? Why is nature important? Why is the cosmos important? I mean, it's something that exists in its own right. History is everything that humanity has ever been. And, of course, prehistory would be everything else. But in terms of the study of history, there are a lot of cliches out there, like if we don't know history, we're condemned to repeat it. I'm not sure that's always the case, because certainly there are certain kinds of patterns in life, dictators rising and conquering great amounts of land and then ultimately, usually, being defeated. But just because you know that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen again. But to me, it's important simply because I love the stories of history, the fact that this is where we come from as people, and that it's interesting just because life is interesting. Anyone who thinks history is boring should probably be reading or studying some other facet of history which isn't boring.
What got you interested in history in particular?
Well, I was hooked really emotionally by history. In my teens, I went to a boarding school in New England. I grew up in Indiana and went to a school in Connecticut called Taft School. When I was just 14 years old, and I was very impressed with the history around me there. There wasn't so much in Indiana, but the old stone walls, the old houses nearby, and this kind of the rolling countryside of Connecticut. And as I was studying American history, I had a real sense of history being all around me, the old churches and that type of thing. And so it wasn't kind of a deliberate choice, oh, am I interested in this, this, or this? I was actually sort of hooked in by that. And then after this, I was 3 years at that school, and then I went to a school called Felsted in Essex, England, which was a boarding school. And in some of the buildings where I was, people like Oliver Cromwell had been there, and Oliver's son, Richard Cromwell, who was for a short time ruler of England before the kings returned, had actually gone to school there. And in a variety of other ways, history was all around me there as well. And then I went to Harvard for my college. And there again, I was in Massachusetts, in Boston, a lot of history around me. So partly I was hooked by the sights and sounds of history in a very real way as something that was still going on. And I think that's one reason today I'm interested in a lot in film and history and show films in class. I'm trying to learn to take good historical films to bring back to my classes, because it's always been in books, yes, but it's also been what excites me is the reality of those kinds of sights and sounds that you can still kind of get the echoes of the past from that today.
So who are some of the people you look up to in American history? Some of the historical figures, I guess.
Well, I particularly like people that are capable of humanity and charity towards others. I admire an obvious one would be Abraham Lincoln, born in Log Cabin and became probably the greatest president we've ever had, certainly the greatest kind of articulator of the vision of America, government of the people, by the people, for the people. I was just talking to my students today about a guy named Sam Houston, and I kind of kid around with him and say, can you think of a city named for this man? Houston, Texas, of course.
But I was thinking Sam, Georgia.
There you go, yeah. Tell you a quick story about him. He was born to some fairly wealthy planters in Tennessee. His teenager felt rebellious, went out and lived among the Cherokee nearby, was semi-adopted by them, learned their language, but grew up, so to speak, and went back to being a plantation owner, became governor of Tennessee, was disappointed in love. He married a young woman whose family said, look, this is the chance of a lifetime. It's the governor. He's a wealthy planter. He wants to marry you. Go ahead and do it. And she did, but she didn't want to be with Sam Houston. And she went home, and he was brokenhearted, just bagged it, packed his bag, literally, and left one day, got on a boat, went down the Mississippi River, left plantation, left his governorship, and found the Cherokee, among whom he'd lived before, was officially adopted by them and became a member of their tribe for several years. Then again returned to white Anglo society, became a planter in Frontier, Texas, which was then owned by the Mexicans, stood up, continued to stand up for Indian rights, and was part of the rebellion where Mexican Texans and American Texans revolted against the central government in Santa Ana, and of course the Alamos, famous episode and all of that. But Sam Houston was central to that and became an important political leader in early Texas history. But what I admire about him is not just, you know, the fact that he's, you know, became famous, but that along the way he's such a human story, a guy disappointed in love and just sort of running away. But even more importantly, the fact that he was friendly with the Cherokee to a point of learning the language, living among them, friendly to the Spanish-speaking Texans. And so a great model for somebody who's multicultural. So those are two people I admire like a lot. One, a slam dunk, an obvious one, Abraham Lincoln. Houston, well-known, but maybe a little bit less well-known. And as I say, it's that capacity to live a kind of multicultural life, which in the year 2005 we think is so important. And yet there are models way back then that took that into account.
And perhaps did a better job than many of our world leaders today and whatnot.
Yeah, arguably. I mean, certainly in terms of learning the languages and living with people of a different culture, that's probably rarer today in some instances.
In all of your research, what has been probably the most interesting thing that you've come across that you find just really blew you away?
Well, I think some of the things are where you know something, but then there are surprises. I'll give you an example of that. Eleanor Roosevelt, I wrote a book about Eleanor Roosevelt, and already knew that she was a great woman and arguably the best first lady we've ever had, certainly the most influential. And there's this sort of statue person of Eleanor Roosevelt. What I hadn't realized is what she struggled through to become who she was. She lost her mother to disease when she was about 11, and very shortly afterwards her father, who already had trouble with drink and drank a lot more in the despair over the loss of his wife, essentially drank himself to death. So this great, famous woman, who was the most famous woman in the world for several decades, was the product of a very tragic early life, was an orphan, raised by her aunt. Her aunt was not able to pay that much attention to her. And somehow she overcame that, married her cousin, fifth cousin Franklin Roosevelt, and kind of slowly emerged from being a kind of a simpering housewife who was afraid to raise her voice to her mother-in-law when her mother-in-law didn't agree with her and was just totally dependent, but slowly became an independent figure and not only was a great first lady where she had her husband's position to build on, but after his death she became the head of the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and what Thomas Jefferson was to the Declaration of Independence, Eleanor Roosevelt was to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the UN Declaration of kind of Bill of Rights, like our Bill of Rights. and tremendously influential around the world. So you're asking about a surprise. That would be a good one. Yeah, obvious she's well known, but most people don't really know how much she did, nor what a really difficult background she came from.
In his stand-up act, Dressed to Kill, British comedian Eddie Izzard makes fun of his American audience by saying that because of the Revolutionary War, British actors always play bad guys in American films, whereas French actors always play more esoteric characters that, quote, turn up and go, "My name is Pierre. I have come from Paris. I have come to have sex with your family." And the audience laughs, but the laughter fades away as he acts out the American's reply, "Oh, help yourself, because of the debt of honor to General Lafayette." The audience more or less falls silent at this point. Izzard looks out over the audience and asks, "You know you're in history, yeah?" There's some nervous laughter, and he continues, "You don't know who he is, do you? In your experience, are most Americans ignorant of their own history?"
Well, certainly parts of history, and it's interesting to ask that question, to try to figure out what a new group of students in my introductory class, what they know and what they don't know. And certainly some of them will get confused by between the Civil War and the Revolutionary War. I mean, things a lot more basic than Lafayette, knowing who Lafayette is. But I think that there is definitely a deficiency in terms of knowing some of the basic history. And historians now are arguing about what really is the basic history. What should we know? Is there a simple canon, you know, a 100-page book that would cover it all? Are there 1,000 names and dates everybody ought to know? And there's a lot of dispute about that. I think of it more in terms of kind of the big picture. Obviously, you should know the Declaration of Independence and ideally the Gettysburg Address and know what some of those things were about. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, to get into those kinds of details, like 1778, the French signed a treaty with the United States, sent troops over. Lafayette was the most famous. That kind of thing is, I bet if you were to ask Americans on the street who Lafayette was, 1 in 10 maybe would know who he was.
He's a street in New York, right?
Yeah. Well, I found it interesting. We were watching The Daily Show the other night, and Bill O'Reilly was on, and he was talking about how much he hates the French and they owe us for World War II. And I keep bringing up, well, didn't that kind of fill what we owed them for the Revolutionary War? I mean, shouldn't we just kind of get over it, get past it? They have.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter how much they owe us. They're going to be French about it. So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's hundreds of other reasons to hate the French besides that, you know, they didn't want to go to Iraq.
Uh-huh. Well, as it turns out, the French were concerned about little things like whether there were weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. whether we were trashing a UN process that maybe we should respect. The further away we get from those debates in the Security Council, the more some of the French cautions make sense. But beyond that, I've always thought it was kind of a strange argument to say that we saved France and that France owes us a great debt. Another way of looking at it was Hitler was our enemy as well.
Yeah.
And France got pounded by Hitler for 2 years before we went in and fought Hitler. So, yeah, if we didn't care about Hitler, then, you know, arguably that was something we did just for the French. But just as we were concerned about Saddam, and wrongly, as it turns out, in terms mm-hmm. of weapons of mass destruction, we had every reason to be concerned about Hitler, and Hitler pounded England and France for 2 years, as I say, before we got our troops in. So I think somehow the notion that we went out and fought Hitler just to be nice to somebody else, not very good reading of history.
Let's move on now to some of the books that you've written. If you could just give us a brief introduction so we know which books they are.
Okay, well, there are basically 5 books. The first one was on the New England ministers in the colonial period, a book about the Puritans, and it's called God's Messengers. The second was a book called American Realities, which is a series of essays on different facets in American history, basically story essays. I mean, they're true, but they tell a story. And the idea there was, along with the textbook that one reads in American history, to go in more depth into certain episodes, like Puritanism, well, the death of a Puritan woman as described by her husband. The Revolutionary War, I focus on the year 1776 when George Washington was losing a lot of battles. In terms of war essays, another one is on Hiroshima, a description of the crew that bombed Hiroshima, how they experienced that. And then also I found interviews and memoirs of people on the ground, mm-hmm. so what it was like there. Notice there's a new film that goes into McCarthyism. One of my essays in there is on McCarthyism. and there are 30 of those essays, and I'm currently doing a revised version of that. It'll be I've lost track. I think it's either the 6th or the 7th. I think it'll be the 7th edition. And every several years, I cycle out some essays and write some new ones. And you might be interested in what I'm doing on that, but shall I run on through the other books?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, book on Eleanor Roosevelt. I mentioned my interest in Eleanor Roosevelt. Then from the Puritans, I was asked to do a book about the Congregational Church, basically the part of the roots of the United Church of Christ today. And so that's a book that starts with the Puritans but comes up to the present. And then finally, a book called The Fair and the Falls about our own Expo 74 in Spokane, which was done with a lot of help from Spokane and students here, and it became the biggest book on any American World Fair since World War II, thanks largely to some fabulous student researchers who were very good at tracking down stories and oral history and so on. All I had to do was write it.
And the fact that it seems like every city that ever had a World's Fair doesn't want to let go of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's a big honor, and maybe especially for Spokane, that it's the we're the smallest city in the world ever to have had a World's Fair.
And it was quite successful here as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and how do you measure that? Well, people say, well, it lost $1 million or something. Well, give me a break. $1 million, and you get your entire downtown urban renewal. You move the railroad tracks that are junking up the falls. You have a park. You have a core for what is now a very vibrant downtown, and it cost $1 million. That's not a bad deal. Plus, the fair itself was, as some people would say, it was we gave a party, the world came, and they paid the bill, because the various countries that set up pavilions helped pay for the fair. So it was fabulously successful by any measure.
On Amazon.com, Tammy Jo Eckert, the famed erotica author and college history instructor, had this to say about your biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. Quote, "With all the time spent in the colleges and universities about how historians need to cite their sources, this biography is a sad and sorry example. Nothing is cited. Even the direct quotes have no citations." How do you respond to a comment such as this?
Well, naturally, I don't say, oh, yeah, she's absolutely right. What a wonderful review. I kind of looked at it, and I think that person has got a record for one of the records on Amazon.com, has something like 500 reviews. I kind of get the impression of somebody spending 5 minutes on it. What I tend to get back from college professors that use the book and so on is people will say, one in the most recent, I just revised it, and students would come to me, the professor said, and say, thank you for assigning that book. Another professor said, a real woman resides here, and this real book really has heart. And this person is focusing on it not having footnotes. Well, give me a break. This is a series called The Library of American Biography, and you don't have footnotes. And I have boxes of research on the book, but they don't have footnotes. So I think it's not maybe the greatest review that I ever saw.
Let's move on to Berkeley real quick here. You earned your PhD from the University of California and were actually at the Berkeley campus when the free speech movement began in the mid-60s. Can you tell us a little bit about that event in general and what in particular you witnessed and how you were affected by the protesters?
Sure. Just one slight corrective. It started in 64. I arrived in 65. So I missed the first year, and some of the famous scenes were in that year. The first big sit-in was Sproul Hall from Sproul Hall Plaza into what was called Sproul Hall. It would be like Showalter Hall at Eastern, mm-hmm. the big campus administrative building. And that was over by the time I arrived. But the next 5 or 6 years were very intense. The whole time I was there, there was one issue or another, and I did witness sit-ins. In some cases, the sit-ins were pretty peaceful. In some cases, fires were built from some of the stuff that was taken out of the buildings. I remember one in particular. The sit-ins started as focusing on literally the issue of free speech on campus. There was supposed to be an area where students could speak as they wanted to, and the university restricted that. And I believe there was a communist speaker that was being denied access to the campus, and those kinds of issues sort of got it going. It's like the Ward Churchill issue in a certain sense at Eastern. Mm-hmm. But that started a set of sit-ins, and this, you got to remember, is the time of the civil rights movement in the South. And a lot of these students had been in the South, had been in sit-ins, saw those tactics, And so they brought it back, and there were a number of issues that came up. Some of them also departments of African American studies, for example. That there was a lot of protest to try to get that going. Ethnic studies in general. In a way, that all paled in comparison to the war as the war came along. 65, 66, 67, it got to be bigger and bigger. And there were peace parades from the get-go. Now, in terms of what I saw there, I saw pretty much samples of essentially everything that happened after the first year. There was a famous episode I wish I'd seen so I could tell my students I saw it, but I didn't. But tear gas, a lot of tear gas. I mean, there'd be demonstrations, and people would sometimes march down Telegraph Avenue, the main avenue by the school, smash windows, and so on. A lot of those were not students, and a lot of students like myself felt that's counterproductive. You just get people mad at you rather than looking at the issues. But quite often there'd be a lot of police around. I mean, and I don't mean just single officers standing here and there, but platoons, 50, 100 or more. And there'd be pitched battles where tear gas would be, demonstrators would be one place 50 yards away, and the police would have tear gas, and it would be lobbed back and forth. I saw that happen. There were times when I taught with tear gas coming into the classroom, and my students sometimes would want to say, hey, let's not have class today, there's this. And I'd say, look, history matters too. You know, we got just 2 hours, let's do this and then go out and do anything else you want to do. I mean, go out and follow your own, you know, the rest of your life is yours. So I was pretty idealistic about it. One thing I decided is history matters too. But in terms of episodes where I was there, one of the most dramatic was something called People's Park, which was 69 or 70. It may have been as late as 70. Students and other people living near the campus identified a lot of about a half a block, pretty large area, as being a place to have a park. And there was no park, and the university wouldn't let them have a park because it was going to be a parking lot, they said. And the students said, well, no, we want to have a park. And they got together and they put in plants and swings and various things for children. There may have been sandboxes. But they essentially took it into their own hands and said, let 1,000 parks bloom. And in the night, the police came in and put a chain link fence around the park. I mean, it was just all done in the night, and then you couldn't go into the park anymore. And there was meetings on campus. And by the way, I was pretty much every lunchtime there'd be a speaker on campus. And these ranged from senators to local college students to the most famous of all, Martin Luther King. But Sproul Hall Plaza, where these would take place, after the after People's Park had this fence around it, there were a lot of speeches about, you know, how terrible this was. You know, why fence this off? People were enjoying it. And students and others began walking down Telegraph Avenue. And I think it was the state police who were there at this time. And they had shotguns with birdshot. And in some cases, actual, whatever you call the full bore shots. And they shot 35 students, killed one, blinded another. And there was a lot afterwards about, you know, did they really need to do this? Weren't there better ways of crowd control? Well, right after that, the National Guard came in. And for several weeks, when I went to campus, I'd walk past National Guard. And some parts of the town, like where I left my laundry and had to pick it up, you actually had to go through a National Guard checkpoint just to get your dry cleaning back. But that was one of the more dramatic, that and the various peace parades that were taking place at that time. And I was, as I told you earlier, I opposed the Vietnam War from pretty early on. And took part in peace parades with as many as 500,000 other people, half a million in San Francisco. Yeah. So I saw a lot of stuff.
What instructions were you given by the administration in terms of how to deal with students and how to sort of act in general on campus?
Well, I was a graduate student, so I was a student, but I was also a teaching assistant, and teaching assistant in the sense of having my own classes, an acting instructor, and We were told that we should continue teaching. There were times when the teaching assistants went on strike, and I'm kind of vague on some of the details on that. I never had to face a dilemma of not teaching, and I've taught 42 years now, and I've missed the most 10 classes in those 42 years. So I, you know, maybe every 2 or 3 or 4 years I'll miss a class.
That's a pretty good track record.
Yeah, right. Well, I just feel like that's where I belong when there's a class to be taught. And I felt it very idealistically then, that even though I opposed the war too. I'll tell you one time I had to dismiss class, and I would go off, and the students would say, oh, there's something that's happened in Vietnam. We've got to cancel class. And I'd say, well, let's wait 2 hours, and then we'll cancel class, because it'll be over. But I went in one day, and they were saying, Mr. Young's or whatever, could we just not have class today? And, I'd start to give my spiel about, look, these other things matter, but history matters too. History mm-hmm. matters. And I could see I wasn't getting through to them, and there were tears in some of their eyes. And, it was like in each case, occasionally now you'll have a student come to you and their mother has died or their father, and you can tell this is more than just, I have a little cold, can I miss class? Well, here's a class of 15 students, and it looks like, each one has lost a brother or a sister. Well, it was the day of, and I hadn't heard of it till that moment, it was the day of Kent State. And their brothers and sisters had been killed at Kent State. And, I said, we're not going to have class today. I can see it's just not going to work.
That sounds like a good excuse to me.
Yeah, I think so. The most moving and tragic event while I was at Berkeley was one that many Americans shared, and that was the death of Martin Luther King. King was respected in a way that's hard to imagine today. There's no single person that has quite the impact of King. And of course, a lot of people didn't like him, but more of us did like him and love him in a way that's very unusual for somebody in public life. But there was a sense that he could talk to you individually while talking to thousands or millions of people. And the I Have a Dream speech would be an example of it. Well, in the 1967, King had decided that he was opposed to the Vietnam War for a couple of reasons. One is that it was particularly hard on African Americans, that about, I think, something like half of the deaths or half of the soldiers in Vietnam were African American at that time. He felt it was taking attention away from the civil rights movement, and also he just felt that it was wrong. And he came to Berkeley, and a number of other speakers had come to Berkeley, but this one was the biggest, and I got there probably an hour early, so I was fortunate enough to stand maybe 50 feet away from him, close enough that I could see the sweat on his brow as he was speaking. And it was just an amazing moment where you felt that you were elevated above the ground. I mean, I really felt, some of those old biblical things of the words of prophets being like mighty rivers. There was that almost a physical impact that he had, and I'll never forget his quoting a poem that says, "Once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side," and goes on to talk about how the scaffold seems to rule the future, but that God behind the scaffold is looking down on humanity and watching out over his own. And the way King said that, I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, and it was just incredibly inspiring. And I'd loved the man before, but I just felt very close to him. And one day I went home about a year later, and my wife, I think, had already had the TV on and told me that King had been killed. And it still brings a lump in my throat. I watched TV and slept poorly and was looking forward to getting back to Berkeley, about a mile away by bike, to get to Sproul Hall Plaza, where I figured I'd see, other people, and there'd be meetings and conversations, and we could just share our sorrow. And as I was going along the street, I noticed, as I was riding along on my bike, looking at people's faces, that it just, it was that look that I was describing with my students at Kent State of tears in the eyes and something horrible having happened. And so there's this shared sense of loss. And I got to a place where I was going to enter Sproul Hall Plaza, but couldn't see it yet, and was very disappointed that I couldn't hear anything. And typically, as you approach Sproul Hall Plaza, you just hear people, wanting you to join this organization or that, and shouting things out, and handing out posters, and handing out leaflets. And there was none of this sound. It was just quiet. And I thought, man, this is disappointing. Don't people care? And I went around the corner, and it wasn't empty. It wasn't just a few people. There were probably 10,000 people in this relatively constricted space. It was just elbow to elbow. And the silence itself just said it all. I mean, nobody needed to say anything. We all knew why we were there. And one of the most moving things about it, again, you know, spiritual tracts, including the Bible, talk about the spirituality of water and flowing water. And there was a fountain in the middle of the plaza that was called Ludwig's Fountain, from some dog that used to play around in it a lot. And you could never hear Ludwig's Fountain. I mean, you could see the water, and sometimes Ludwig himself, the very dog, but you could never hear it. And this day, even with 10,000 people there, you heard the fountain. And it was just an incredibly powerful feeling of loss, but also of solidarity with this man and what he stood for. So that was a pretty amazing moment.
I can imagine. So these are the three questions that I ask everybody. And the first question is, if you couldn't be a historian, what other job would you like to have?
Well, I'm really getting into photography. I've always been interested in still photography, and in the last several years I've gotten more into filmmaking. So I wouldn't necessarily have answered it this way 5 years ago, but a filmmaker.
That's a very interesting choice.
It is.
All right, the next question is, what is your favorite word?
You know, it's kind of like people asking what your favorite color is. I never used to know. I do know now, but that's another question, which you didn't ask me, and I'm stalling for time. You know, I'm not sure I have one. Mesopotamia is an interesting word. It was said there was a preacher in colonial times who was a charismatic preacher, and his voice was fabulous, and it was said that just the way he said Mesopotamia could have you shaking in your boots. Well, let's leave it at Mesopotamia.
Good word.
And finally, what was it? I'll
give you another one.
Okay, sure.
Onomatopoetic. And it's been a while since I've defined that one, but it has to do with certain kinds of sound.
That's a very good one. I like that one. Okay, finally, here we have, what turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally?
Well, I'd say arguably the same thing in my writing, in my film photography, and in life. And that is where I capture a moment. And I see it particularly in photography now. I think it's amazing as I take pictures of people, say, at a party or just friends doing something, that there's something that fascinates me in a certain look that a person will have, a way they'll talk to somebody else, some sort of glance. And I found it in writing, too, something where there's just some sort of sense of life. Somebody says something, an Eleanor Roosevelt statement or whatever, where I just feel that the world has stopped at that moment. And by the way, I got confirmation of this last night. There's a new Apple product. They've got a new announcement every week, it seems, and it's called Aperture. And it's for editing what are called RAW files, really big, tough files in photography. And apparently it's a huge breakthrough. And on the website, they have three photographers talking about Aperture. And you have movies, and then you have of the photographer taking his stuff, and then you have him talking about what he's doing. And there was a sports photographer who says that, to me, the essence of what my job is not, you know, the big score or the big touchdown, but it's that moment where somebody, you can see an emotional response to something that's just happened. So in terms of what turns me on, I'd say it's those moments where something just, it could be very simple, but somehow it's just captures life at that moment. The world seems to stand still. And I try to write about those, and I'm now trying to photograph them. Occasionally I try to catch the students in that web.
Well, we've been talking with Eastern Washington University History Professor Dr. Bill Youngs. I want to thank you for joining us here on Allopod. And we'll have a link to his books on the show notes.
What a deal.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. My pleasure.
You watch in the sky. Thank you.
Was another song by Eric Ostrom called You Were Watching the Sky. So you see what I mean there?
Yeah.
That was very different.
Yeah.
But I really like the moods he you know, puts into the song are very cool. Moro had said that she wanted to point out something else here about antiviral Kleenex. What was it you wanted to say?
Well, basically, when we were talking about how soap kills viruses, basically, speaking of marketing soap to kill viruses, antiviral Kleenex is basically soap in Kleenex.
Why isn't the Kleenex all goopy, Maura?
Well, I don't know how they get it in the Kleenex, but I was looking at the ingredients on the box, and basically it's the main ingredient that's in hand soap.
So they just mix in soap with the...
Some soapy thing.
Weird.
There you go. See? For more myths dispelled here. You don't need antibacterial soap all over your damn house.
No.
In fact, that's actually probably worse for you.
Yeah, because it lowers your immunity.
Because you have bacteria growing on you that is supposed to be there. And that, there weren't those tampons a while back with OB, I think they were. They had some sort of antibacterial agent in them to help.
Back in the 70s? Are they talking about the ones that were like killing women?
They were killing women.
Yeah, with the TSS?
Yeah, because it was they had an antibacterial agent that was supposed to help kill the bacteria that caused, you know, unpleasant odors. And
that's right.
It also killed their natural flora, and that killed them.
Yeah. You can't mess around down there.
There's a lot of chemistry.
There's a lot of actually laws involved with that particular part of a woman that you really don't want to screw with that will get you really sick.
Yeah, definitely not, because by killing the normal flora down there, you allow other not-so-great bacteria to flourish, and therefore the Staph aureus with the toxic shock syndrome toxin can propagate and, you know, release that toxin, causing the toxic shock syndrome. And
I think we should devote a whole show to TSS and vaginas. I'm going to just say it, vaginas. Yeah, we'll have to get a
wait, here, let's do it on three. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Vaginas. All right. You're listening to Allopod. Luckily, we don't report to anyone, because otherwise we wouldn't get to say vaginas a lot. On a completely unrelated note, here's Andrew Burton's haiku entitled Batteries.
Batteries. Battery is low. Charging, charging, charging. Then, battery is dead?
We're running out of time here quickly, so we've got some shout-outs we'd like to give. Emily, would you want to run down a few shout-outs here?
I got a shout-out for Jamie in Boise, Idaho.
Uh-huh. I have one for Derek from Skepticality, who wrote in.
I've got Jason in Vancouver, B.C.
Daniel in Honolulu. Ooh. I also have Sydney in Chicago.
I have Kalila in Chicago.
They should hook up.
They should.
No. Jordy in Barcelona, and to whoever's listening to us in South Africa, you rock. You've been listening to Allopod. You can find the show notes with links to all of the articles and stories and various random things we've talked about, as well as Andrew Burton's website. Mm-hmm. And that's at alifelessordinary.com, and click on podcast. It's on the left-hand side of the navigational menu. If you want to send us anything, kudos, you want to hear your name in the shout-outs.
Send us stuff.
Send us interview ideas. If you want to be interviewed, anything along those lines. If you have music that you want to get out there, the email address is podcast@alifelessordinary.com. My name is Thomas J. Brown.
And I'm Emily J. Kratzer.
Thank you for listening to Allopod. And remember, vagina.
Vagina.
Vagina.